You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Milwaukee photographer is one of the few people nationwide keeping a Civil War-era technology alive. We'll learn what makes the process so special. Now, President Trump issued the second veto of his presidency yesterday on a resolution that would have ended American military support in the war in Yemen. The war is in its fourth year, and it's caused a famine that's killed thousands of civilians in Yemen. Dalia Fahmy is an associate professor of political science and an expert on politics in the Middle East from Long Island University, Brooklyn. Dalia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is currently the American military role in Yemen?
So currently, it is relatively limited in that it is non-combatant technical assistance. We don't have boots on the ground. We provide logistical assistance, satellite imagery, but more importantly, the United States is selling arms to Saudi Arabia at an alarming rate. For example, just in the past 10 years, Saudi Arabia has purchased weapons and arms from the United States totaling $350 billion. And a big chunk of it is just since 2013. And so when we look at the amount of arms Saudi Arabia has today in its arsenal and how much of it is being used in Yemen and how much logistical support is given by the United States, although it is a Saudi-led coalition or a Saudi-led effort, it is heavily supported by the United States.
Can you talk about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, both from direct military attacks and from the resulting famine?
Sure. So I heard your statistic about a few thousand. Actually, the statistics, according to the Center for Armed Conflict Location and Vendetta Project, it's upward of 80,000 when you include those who are indirectly affected. If you look at the entire population of Yemen today, which is about 30 million, the UN estimates that 80% or 24 million of them are actually in need. And 14 million of them, half the population, is in acute need. More than 20 million people, two-thirds of the population, are food insecure, and 10 million suffer from extreme levels of hunger. Two-thirds of the population doesn't have access to water or to health care. So the country that is essentially a port country that should have access to the world is completely cut off today because of the nature of the bombardment of ports, hospitals, and schools.
Can you talk us through how this war got started locally at first, I guess, and then internationalized?
So locally, just as most of the Arab Spring nations in 2011, this started as a popular uprising, but we saw very quickly the removal of the leader, and then it crumbled into civil war with a lot of foreign intervention from Saudi Arabia and Iran, because there is a sectarian nature to it evolved into a sectarian conflict between Sunni and Shia rebel groups, but essentially it wasn't the core issue. And so when you see Saudi Arabia and Iran pivoting through their struggle of who's going to emerge as the leader from in the Middle East, as they are also fighting in Syria, you're starting to see this co-opting of a conflict by major power players. And here you see the heavy-handed nature of Saudi Arabia.
Dalia Fahmy is with us from Long Island University, Brooklyn, looking at the civil war in Yemen, a vote in Congress to end U.S. military aid to the Saudi Arabian coalition in Yemen, and President Trump's veto of that congressional resolution. This action from Congress, Dalia, it's not something we see all the time, Congress stepping in and saying, executive branch, stop this military operation. Can you talk about what you saw from Congress here?
You're absolutely right. You know, the War Powers Act essentially was enacted because of the Vietnam War, and it was really to curtail the power of the president to put the United States in a protracted conflict. And so what we saw from Congress was a couple of things. This was bipartisan, and it was from both branches, saying that the president can't enter into a war or continue in a war where there is no clear exit strategy. And this signals also the president's lack of respect or heeding the warnings of several generals on the nature of conflict and how he has been engaging in the Middle East. For example, withdrawing with troops from Syria very quickly, and this protracted conflict in Yemen with no clear exit strategy. And this signals from Congress that President Trump's continued support of this Saudi regime is coming into question. Now, we saw this earlier this year and late last year with the death of the Washington Post contributor Jamal Khashoggi, which was spoken about throughout the world but was not condemned clearly by our president to the Saudi regime, especially in his meetings with them. And then again, earlier this year, when there was this embrace of reforms from the current leader of Saudi Arabia, until his father actually gives it to him, Mohammed bin Salman, that he's a great reformer. And yet, although there has been the symbolic women can drive, most of the feminist leaders who actually led that movement are in prison. And we've seen not just the arrest of feminists, but many of the reformers and activists in Saudi Arabia. And yet the president, our president, remains silent on this and continues to herald Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, as a reformer. And so what we're seeing from Congress is this rejection of how the president is conducting foreign policy in the Middle East. And yet today this veto, or yesterday's veto, says that, no, the president is not going to be in keeping with what's coming out of Congress. Now, on one hand, this is understandable. The president says, I don't want Congress to tell me what I can do. I'm the commander of the military. And that has been the mantra of many U.S. presidents, President Obama and President Clinton as well. But this is a little different in that the United States is engaged in a protracted conflict with no clear exit strategy that our own military leaders are saying we should not be in.
What did the Obama administration do in the early days of this Yemeni conflict?
The Obama administration in the early days of the Yemeni conflict and much of the conflicts of the Arab Spring was hedging its bets. You know, they were silent in that it wasn't clear what was happening in the Middle East and the Levant. And so there was the keeping it at bay as long as it didn't spill over. And this might have allowed this to turn into a civil war, just as the one in Yemen did. In Syria did. But this allowed for the heavy-handed involvement of Saudi Arabia, and that is not in keeping with U.S. national interest.
Is there any kind of prospect for a peaceful resolution in Yemen? There's been a unsteady, I gather, ceasefire, but people are skeptical that that's going to last too long. What do you see, I guess, on the hopeful side?
There has been a couple of attempts at ceasefires that have been violated by continued bombing of ports. But we have seen certain steps taken more recently by coalitions from different leaders of the Arab world to step in Yemen. However, until Saudi Arabia's power over this war is curtailed, and that can only come from withdrawing U.S. support, this will still be one of the spheres that Saudi Arabia is trying to put a heavy-handed footprint.
So you see the U.S. having leverage, should it choose to use it, to help bring this conflict to a close?
Absolutely. Saudi Arabia cannot do it this on its own, cannot conduct war on its own. It relies very heavily until recently on the United States, for example, for refueling of planes. It relies on the United States for tactical support, for logistical support, for training, but more importantly, for satellite imagery. And so they cannot continue to be engaged in a war without heavy support from the United States.
We'll leave it there for now. Dahlia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dahlia Fahmy, professor of political science and an expert on politics in the Middle East from Long Island University, Brooklyn. She was with us today to talk about the war in Yemen and President Trump's veto of a resolution that would have ended American military support for Saudi Arabia there. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin artist who's bringing back a Civil War-era technology for taking photographs. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin artist who's creating portraits the same way people did in the 1850s without a film and without a smartphone. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about losing a child.
We all grieve in different ways. It's painful. It lingers. Nikotris Perkins recently wrote about the heartache of losing her daughter for Exfabula, a storytelling organization based in Milwaukee.
As around the sun the earth knows she's revolving, and the rosebuds know to bloom in early May, just as hate knows love's the cure, you can rest your mind assured that I'll be loving you always. I sang that song every day for almost 7 months. I sang it in the shower. I sang it while cutting veggies for dinner. I belted it loud in the car. And towards the end, Ari sang it with me. Nikotris Ari Oya was born May 9th, 2018, but she never took a breath. I held her for hours after she was born and was able to sing live for her before we parted ways for the final time. In those moments, I learned that love could be still. The deepest relationship I've ever had, Ari taught me the complexity of love. Love is warmth, but sometimes it's just a memory of warmth in damp and cold places. Love is wide, wide open, but often in the confines of a situation. Love is peace, if only in your heart while a storm rages around you. Love, her love, was pure goodness, and it left a wake of damage. The love we shared, coupled with her passing, damaged a lot of things. It damaged my hope. It's damaged many of my relationships. It still shakes my optimism. As a person that used to see the brighter side of everything, I'm learning that grief, which is many ways a demonstration of love, can shift or even damage perspective. There are days when I'm elated the sun is shining, and there are days when, though the sun is shining, I am walking around in darkness. Ari didn't just change me. She taught so many people. She brought goodness out of people. She reminded people of how precious life is and how important it is to live in motion instead of watching the world go by. Nikatris Ari Oya was the sixth Nikatris. She perhaps will be the last Nikatris. And in her very short journey, she strengthened my village on my behalf. She ensured that I understood my value in the lives of those around me. And though the damage that has been done is irreparable, I know the goodness of love like I've never known it before. My name is Nikatris Perkins, and I am the mother of Nikatris Ari Oya. I am a little damaged, but I am oh so good.
Nikatris Perkins lives in Milwaukee. She wrote that story about her daughter for the storytelling organization Ex Fabula. The Story Slam theme for the night was Damaged Goods. I asked Perkins why she decided to share that particular experience with the world.
And I thought about Damaged Goods because I think about how much I learned, loved, and see the world in a better place, even though, like, this is still a, it still hurts. Like, it's still a really hard situation. And grief is complicated. And I think that people walk around invisible in their grief. It's one of those things that, like, once there's a funeral and a repast and lasagna that's been dropped off has been eaten, the world around you kind of just goes back like, oh. But people can be living for years, like, trying to repair their lives from loss. And I wasn't necessarily trying to help people, like, here's a story that's going to fix it for everybody. But just, like, as a reminder that people are walking around on Earth, saying good morning and eating donuts and dinner and coffee with you and figuring out so many things beneath the surface. And, like, the more we remember that, the better I think our relationships would be and the better we would treat people.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You can find more Wisconsin Life stories at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. Now, while many people have left behind film cameras and even digital camera sales have declined, a Milwaukee artist is revisiting a photography style much older and much less portable than those we're familiar with today. She's been taking portraits of Milwaukee residents, visitors, bands, even wedding and pregnancy photos for a few years now, reviving the technique known as tintype photography, popularized in the 1850s. Margaret Musa is a Milwaukee-based wet plate photographer. She was the 2017-2018 artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel and now has her own studio space where she takes tintype photographs. Margaret joins us in our Milwaukee studio. Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, how did you get into this particular type of photography?
I actually read an article about this process, and I was not a photographer at all, but something about this article describing how you could still take a photograph the way that they did during the Civil War, just made me want to learn. And I ended up going to New York to take a workshop on the process, and I've been doing it ever since.
Now, if I were to sit for a portrait with you, what is my experience? What happens? It's not just a quick snap of a picture.
No, it's not. It takes me at about the fastest I can go is taking one picture every 15 minutes. So for my subject, if we're outside, that does mean that you would have to hold still for a few seconds or longer, depending on the light. But at my studio, I have strobes, so I can capture children and even pets in literally just a flash. So it's pretty easy for the subject under that light.
And tell us a little bit about the technology. What are you doing to take this image?
Well, it starts with a metal or glass plate that I coat with an emulsion called collodion. And then the emulsion on the plate becomes light sensitive after I dip the whole plate into a bath of silver nitrate for a few minutes. And then after it's been sensitized in that bath, I load it directly into the back of my large format camera, expose the plate, and then I actually have to develop the plate while the chemistry is still wet. So it's called the wet plate process because everything, development and all, has to happen while the chemistry is wet.
Now, what that makes me think, you know, the way I take pictures, apart from badly, is, you know, take lots of them, hope one of them comes out. The kind of effort it takes to make this one image has got to, I don't know, it's got to change the way you think about what you're doing. What, as an artist, what is going through your mind as you're catching that image?
It's slow. A lot of people are, you know, I get a lot of questions like, do I really only get one shot? And I mean, I definitely take my time for the image, every single one. And, you know, it's depending on how you look at it, it's a slow process or it's really fast. I mean, by the time we set out to make the image, we're looking at it in less than 10 minutes, and that's pretty magic.
And I looked at some of the images you have up on your website, and it's really interesting. I mean, these are clearly modern-day people, but in this, we've seen those 1850s, 1860s Civil War-era tintypes, and it looks very historical at the same time. How would you describe the end result of the images you take?
Yeah, this process sees something a little bit different. And that's a result of not only the camera, which is, you know, I use old cameras. A lot of the cameras I have are from the early 1900s with giant brass lenses on them. And this type of camera, large format, has the bellows in the center, and that a camera like that has a really dramatic effect on focus. So that means I can get someone's eyes in like the clearest, sharpest focus, and then, you know, anything like a foot behind them starts to blur into the background, which is a really dramatic and kind of romantic effect. But then furthermore, the chemical process leaves sometimes certain artifacts around the edges. You know, my fingerprints are kind of just there in the corners of all the plates that I make. A fleck of dust that might be on the emulsion could cause a little comet across the plate. So it's really kind of cool, the things that show up.
Talking to Margaret Musa about her tintype or wet plate photography. She's an artist based in Milwaukee. Margaret, the final product, I would walk away with a piece of tin, right, with the image on it. I'd have this metal sheet.
Yeah, that's right. There are no negatives in this process. So each image is a direct positive exposed directly onto a metal plate.
And how hard was this to get good at?
I'm still trying to get good at it. I say I've been doing this for almost 5 years, and I'm learning all the time. I still come across issues that I don't understand, and there aren't a lot of people that can help. So really, you know, in the end, it's just up to me to figure this process out. And that's what really holds my interest in doing this forever, really. I love it. It's a challenge, and it's really fun.
And now an artistic product you're involved in caught our eye here. You and I believe your sister are getting ready to start this unique sort of studio environment in an Old West ghost town.
That's right. My oldest sister is the only person that lives in a town called Cisco out in Utah, which is an old abandoned railroad town. And she's been living out there for years. And she and my other sister, Renee, started a nonprofit and started an art residency program out there. So you can spend a month in the ghost town and get a little stipend and make art completely, you know, distraction-free out in the desert with a beautiful view of the mountains and lots of ruin at your disposal to use for tools. And applications for that are open right now at eileenmusa.org.
And finally, that's a unique environment to do art in. You do most of your work. You're based in Milwaukee. What's it like? What's the Milwaukee environment like for you and your tintype photography and other artistic endeavors?
Milwaukee has been so supportive of what I do. From the residency at the Pfister, I've gotten a lot more people who have heard about me. And so I feel so lucky that I kind of get to make a career out of this very strange process. I feel really lucky about that.
And as we wrap up, when somebody ends up with this cool Civil War looking image of themselves on a piece of metal, what kind of reactions do you get?
Oh, I mean, it's really special for people because this type of image is something that, you know, can be passed down for generations. It's really like an heirloom quality image. And so I get a lot of families, and it is really meaningful for me to see them so happy with their portraits of, you know, kids or whether it be a couple. And so it's really cool to know that these images are going to be in households and be passed down for generations to come.
Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Margaret Musa, Milwaukee-based wet plate photographer. She was the 2017-2018 artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel and now has her own studio space where she takes tintype photographs, the Civil War era photography method. You can see examples of her work at her website, margaretmusa.com. That's M-U-Z-A, margaretmusa.com. Coming up, we'll take a look at a Wisconsin Public Television documentary just out on small town and rural life here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin's new corrections secretary joins Kate Archer Kent for a look at incarceration reform, the ongoing efforts to close the state's troubled youth prison, and other issues in criminal justice. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, whether you've lived in a rural part of America and can't imagine living anywhere else, or you just aren't sure you understand the appeal of the country life, a new documentary shares the stories of Wisconsin rural communities and the ups and downs in the lives of the people who live there. Andy Soth is a producer for Wisconsin Public Television. His work has appeared on Here and Now, WisContext, and Wisconsin Life. His new full-length documentary is called Portraits from Rural Wisconsin. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. It's great to be here.
What caught your eye? This focuses on western Wisconsin in particular. What caught your eye about this part of the state?
Well, I would say, it's beautiful, of course.
I
would say that to start with. But I will say, while this is not a political documentary, mm-hmm. that was my starting point coming out of the 2016 election and looking at places in Wisconsin that had previously supported Obama and then had swapped to Trump. I could have took that as an indication of some dissatisfaction, but also since it was not a predicted outcome, that maybe the media was not doing such a great job of covering those areas. And then I saw that there was a concentration of counties along the Mississippi River where this had happened. So I wanted to find one sort of geographic location to concentrate my storytelling, and that's sort of why I came up with those western Wisconsin counties.
And as you mentioned, this is not a documentary about politics, and the word portraits is in the title. Talk about what you're trying to do with these portraits of people in communities.
Right, exactly. So portraits, we often think is a portrait of an individual. These are meant to be individual profiles. The background to these people's lives, they are dealing with issues that are making rural life a challenge. But to the degree possible, I wanted to bring viewers into the lives of these people who they may not know. They may not know about their lives. And so Portrait seemed like a fitting title for what is a series of individual profiles strung together and telling a story, a larger story over the course of a year.
Well, one poignant one, and one that fits a lot with what we talk about here on Central Time. We actually today we're talking about dairy pricing. A big issue. It affects a lot of people in the state. You feature a family living in the area who had to make a difficult decision, ultimately to give up their fourth-generation farm. I want to give a listen to Jenny Patnode reading from a blog post she wrote to inform friends and family about their last milking.
Tomorrow morning, the alarm clock will go off early, 4:30 a.m., to board our dairy cows on trucks and trailers for them to live on other farms. There isn't a book for this. There probably should be, but no one wrote about what to do next when you sell your fourth-generation family farm. No one wrote a book about how to get through that last milking, tears never seeming to end as you hold each other tight with no words to be spoken.
And to frame this, I mean, she's reading this. Her husband couldn't tell the story because he's in tears. He can't express how he feels about this.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the Patnodes are a wonderful family, and because you know Jenny had done that blog post and it had gotten a lot of attention, I was comfortable approaching them about telling their story. But of course, many people have that story. They were just willing to share it, and you know, I first talked to them just about a month after they had sold their cows and ceased their operation, and yeah, the feelings were very raw and immediate.
And one thing I love about how you brought that story is, you know, we hear the statistics all the time about dairy farm closures in Wisconsin and many of the other things you talk about. Putting a face, a human face on that story, I think is really valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, in forming the program, I kept wondering, do I bring in these, you know, examples, these statistics? You know, this is one family of 500 that have ceased their operations. But no, we decided to kind of just keep it in the immediacy of the people that you're meeting.
And I want to make it clear, this is not all sad stories. A lot of this is about people who love the community they live in and the lifestyle they can lead there. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. And yes, stay tuned if you do watch the program because we follow up with the Patnodes. And yeah, there are lots of efforts. I mean, there's lots of engagement and efforts. So we go to see some small economic development, an effort to bring some beer tourism to Soldiers Grove. We go to a manufacturing plant that's very successful at recruiting workers because they use the appeal of rural life to get dedicated workers. So we do follow a lot of the dairy industry. I think we know, you know, because people are reporting on those numbers. That's sort of an arc throughout the story, and that's tough. But there are good things happening, and there are definitely people, you know, working hard to preserve this way of life that they love.
Talking to Andy Soth from Wisconsin Public Television about his new documentary. It's called Portraits from Rural Wisconsin. Well, I want to listen to a bit of the documentary now, Andy, that's relevant to us. Some of our colleagues in the radio world at WRDN in Pepin County, a big kind of a hub for the community. Here's a clip of the station owner explaining what matters to his audience.
You know, work hard and mind your own business and respect your neighbors, respect your elders. All the basics, the golden rule, really resonates with a lot of these people in our part of the state or really in anywhere in rural America.
Did a lot of the people you talked to, whether they're in the documentary or not, talk about kind of what they see as the rural values?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, most people, if you talk to why they live in the country, it's sort of a reflection of that. And I tried to frame the whole documentary with that by starting in Pepin County during Laura Ingalls Wilder's days, because I think Laura Ingalls Wilder, for, you know, everyone, city people in cities or in small towns, they kind of grow up with that acculturation with the idea of these are the values of the frontier that we still associate with rural America. And if I could just take a digression, mm-hmm. Of course, I loved being at a radio station as a media person. And not only they do, you know, country music that kind of reflects those values, they also do a terrific service of agricultural reporting to their audience. And another digression for WPR listeners is I came in contact with them because I was looking for media, and I found that Martha Gingras, who's another staff person there, had gone to UW-Superior. And I just called and said, were you a student of Mike Simonson? And just let the floodgates open. And
our late colleague from the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Right, exactly. And so that was just a kind of a great connection to make and really opened the door for me to meet Martha and that community.
Now, a common theme, talking about those values, there was concern that people are losing these values, that they're because of economic changes, social changes, people have different reasons for it. But the idea that we love these values, we love the way the community comes together, but we're worried that that's going away.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, I think there is sort of a culture and lifestyle change. A lot of it is rooted in economic changes, but a lot of it is just in lifestyle changes. I mean, you look at, these small dairies are challenged, but they're also challenged by changes in life, that people don't have the big families that become the, you know, the work pool for the farm. There's much more sort of activity in sports, you know, lots of involvement outside of the farm, which, you know, can be socially good, but it's definitely a part of a cultural change that's making it much harder to sustain these small dairies.
And one other thing that's hard to sustain, some of the communities around Wisconsin, I've seen this elsewhere in the state, rely for their ambulance and firefighting services, right, things like that, on right, local volunteers to be fully staffed. You talked to the head of Durand Emergency Response, who's worried about the decline in the number of people willing or able to sacrifice their time to volunteer for these things. Here's a listen.
It's built on that agrarian foundation of farmers, neighbors helping each other out. And that's something that I think even us in these rural communities have lost that and have lost understanding that.
So talk a little more about that. He's seeing a very practical and tangible effect of that change.
Yeah, absolutely. There are many factors in that change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of them are sort of economic. You maybe don't have as much locally owned businesses where someone, a business person might be forgiving of, a staff person who will just leave during the middle of the day to go on a call. You know, that might not be as important to where, you know, a corporate headquarters that's on the East Coast. Or there are just fewer local businesses. People have to do these long commutes. So there are lots of economic factors that are kind of also influencing this cultural change.
We're talking to Andy Soth, producer for Wisconsin Public Television, and we're talking about his full-length documentary. It's available to watch now. It's called Portraits from Rural America. You can see it at WPT.org. Before I invite callers, Andy, it's got a couple broadcasts coming up. For those who aren't going to watch it online, when can they catch that on WPT?
Sure. It's Portraits from Rural Wisconsin. Maybe you said America.
Oh, so I'm
maybe,
sorry, rural Wisconsin.
Maybe,
I typed it wrong
follow
here.
Up. Yeah, no problem. So it is available at WPT.org, but I know that lots of people in rural areas don't have great broadband service. So there are re-airings. So Friday at 3 p.m., it'll be repeated on our main channel. Sunday at 5 on the Wisconsin channel, our secondary channel.
Well, we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. If you now live or have lived in a rural area, tell us what makes that kind of life unique to you. Why do you love living in the country? And if you live in a small town or rural part of the state, are there changes going on that you're happy about or that you're worried about or maybe a little bit of both? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Andy Soth. He's in our studio with us talking about his new documentary, Portraits of Rural Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your stories about living in a rural or small town part of the state? Do you live there now or did you grow up there? What do you love about it? What challenges do you or your community face? And what do you wish people who don't live in rural communities, what do you wish they knew about what it's like to live there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll bring on a caller now. Willie is with us in Steuben. Willie, hi.
Hey, how's it going, you guys? Hey, I grew up in Steuben, and I live here now, population 131 or something. And I, when I was in high school, all I could think about was getting out of here and away from here. I joined the Marine Corps and saw a bunch of the world, and it didn't take me very long to realize that I was going back to where I came from because these are the people. If you have a flat tire, somebody will stop and help you. If you run out of gas, people help each other. I can't stress that part that you guys already brought up enough. I live on a dead-end road, and I love it. I can't stress it enough. It's just wonderful to be not in an anthill of humanity.
Willie, thanks a lot for the call. That reminds me, Andy, of people helping each other. You focus a little bit on Gays Mills and the flood there a couple years back and the reaction when, I think it was local newspaper, got flooded out.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that was a very emotional story. And, you know, the newspaper that I spoke to talked about, you know, the community, everyone coming to help. And you hear that again and again. I mean, there is, you know, like with the emergency services, it's neighbors helping neighbors. You hear that again and again. And it's really true. And as far as that flat tire, many times you're off in the van and you're wanting to get a, you know, a shot of a landscape. You're off the side of the road and someone's going to stop by and say, are you okay?
Okay.
And that happened again and again. And I can just say that story is so true of people wanting to leave when they're younger and then see the value of that town. And one person I talked to said, every reason I wanted to leave, it's because, you know, everyone knows who you are. Everyone knows what you're doing. When I had kids, I wanted that.
And that's it. We hear that again and again in small towns. I mean, there is the populations go down in some small towns because the people leave and don't come back. This is a concern. Were people worried about that, the people who left and didn't come back, that in the towns you were in?
Sure. Well, I didn't deal with the population of people who had left.
Obviously, yeah.
But I did. Definitely there are people who had been away and had come back. And what's interesting is, you know, when you talk to people who are doing economic development, they're concerned about that population loss. You know, they're saying they're not even going to try to attract young people. But they do know that when people maybe get late 20s, early 30s, they settle down, you know, there is a return. And that's maybe the group that they're sort of trying to market for. Maybe not, you know, millennials living in Chicago, but people who are, you know, who look back and kind of feel like, well, that was a great childhood for me. That's where I want to raise my children.
Willie, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Jackie with us in Hillsboro. Jackie, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I feel like I'm going to elaborate on everything you just said, but it's true. I'm a dairy farmer outside of Hillsboro with my family, and one of our roofs collapsed this winter due to the heavy snowfall. And within 3 hours and 20 people, because we phoned one guy and he phoned two friends, we had it all cleaned up and safe for our animals. It is a wonderful thing to be in rural Wisconsin.
Jackie, thanks so much for sharing that story. And Andy, I'm guessing you heard a lot of stories like this that didn't end up in the documentary.
Oh, absolutely. Again and again, yeah.
Jackie, thanks so much for sharing that. We'll go now to Rachel with us in Fort Atkinson. Rachel, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Rachel?
I just want to say that I really appreciated growing up in a rural town, not only because the traffic is better than the big city, but because we're the dairy state. Wisconsin, our whole state was founded on these farms, and the community and the tight connections that we have because we are rural, I think, is really what makes Wisconsin great.
Rachel,
it's a great place to raise kids.
Thanks for the call. So the kind of feeling like you're part of that that history of the state, it sounds like Rachel is talking about, Andy.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think, you know, I think everyone in Wisconsin is a part of that in the way that, you know, it didn't just happen that we had these small dairy farms. This was kind of intentional. This is a big part of the Wisconsin idea. So a lot of time and effort and tax dollars and research.
And university research.
Absolutely. So in a way that, you know, everyone in Wisconsin is invested in dairy. It was a great way to provide families with a living. It was a great way to kind of feed an economy. So it's not, even if you've never been on a dairy farm, it is part of Wisconsin. It's part of our culture. It's part of our heritage. And I don't want to say it's part of our history because that makes it feel like it's going away too quickly. But it remains a very important part of the life here.
Rachel, thanks for that call. The documentary, though, makes it clear that dairy isn't the only story. I want to give a listen. You talked to the founder of Building Automation Products, or BAPI, located in the Kickapoo Valley. Rich Stevenson says he wants his workers to enjoy rural living and the amenities.
It's a lot more quiet lifestyle than you have in the city, but there's plenty to do. My passion is bow hunting, canoe, bike, fish, hike, bird watch.
So this is in western Wisconsin, a small town western Wisconsin, and they're making sensors and climate control devices and things like that, kind of high tech.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as I said in the documentary, walking to that plant, you feel more like you're in the Silicon Valley than the Kickapoo Valley. And yeah, it's just exactly what you you wouldn't expect to see it. And their strategy, you know, which I think is very clever, is they know there are enough people there who maybe have advanced degrees, maybe study manufacturing or marketing or what have you, but love easy access to recreation. They love the quiet lifestyle. They love living in a beautiful area. So it's not necessarily going to abroad job fairs or just trying to get as many applicants as possible, but being selective and finding those people who really like those amenities.
Talking to Andy Soth from Wisconsin Public Television. His new documentary is called Portraits from Rural Wisconsin. Back to your calls now. Ron is with us in Norwalk. Ron, hi.
Yeah, hi, Rob. Good afternoon, Andy. I got a chance to watch your documentary, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
It really resonated with me. I grew up on a dairy farm, and I left the state for most of my career and came back to the farm and built a house here and whatnot. And there's a draw when you live and raised on a farm. That land somehow, you get attached to it, and it's just a draw for me. One thing that really resonated with me in your documentary was you referenced it earlier, that couple that had to sell their cows and do something else. My first cousin, Mike, just sold his cows here first of the year. And boy, all those things they went through, you know, it happens thousands of times, unfortunately, but you really documented that well. I mean, it's really hard. You know, those are cows that all had names, and they were out on pasture still. And, you know, the way we used to farm as well. So,
but Ron, thanks a lot for calling in. And it probably everybody knows somebody in these communities who's had to make that decision, Andy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Ron. One story I wanted to bring in, part of the story of rural Wisconsin is immigration. And you focused in on a church that had a unique service. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. Tomorrow is Maundy Thursday, and I was there
right
a year ago on Maundy Thursday. And that's so in the small town of Arcadia, they've had a great deal of immigration attracted to the furniture factory and a chicken processing plant. And that's affected the whole town. But as a microcosm of that is the Catholic Church that is, you know, integrating a Spanish-speaking population. And so usually they have separate services, but during Holy Week, they do a bilingual service. And so I was there for the Monday-Thursday service.
Right. And just talk about what that was like. You got a little English, a little Spanish, and these two different communities sharing the pews.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, both the priests, there was a priest from Mexico and a priest from Poland, which is interesting because most of Arcadia's early immigration population is either from Poland or Germany. But they both talked about what, you know, the unity of a shared faith.
As we start to wrap up, Andy, I hate to ask you this because you just got this one on broadcast. Is there a sequel coming up, or are you going to hit another part of the state now and do a similar project?
Well, there's nothing planned at this scale, but this is definitely an area that I'm still interested in. And I think if you return to the webpage where we've embedded the video, we're going to keep adding to that. There are going to be stories that are related. So I think maybe not another 60-minute standalone documentary, but it's definitely an area that we're going to keep focusing on.
Well, Andy, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Andy Soth, producer for Wisconsin Public Television. His work has appeared on Here and Now, WisConText, and Wisconsin Life. He joined us to talk about his first full-length documentary. It's called Portraits from Rural Wisconsin. You can watch that online at WPT.org. And some of those other follow-up videos that he just mentioned, you can also check WPT.org for broadcast times to watch the full documentary. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, tariffs cost Americans $1.4 billion a month in lost income. That's according to a Federal Reserve report. A Wisconsin expert on international trade breaks down those numbers for us. The redacted Mueller report is expected to be released tomorrow. We'll get a first look at what is and isn't in the much-anticipated document and look at some of the political back and forth that I expect we'll hear about by that time. And if you have trouble getting enough sleep, you're not alone. A sleep expert will share some of the latest research and some possible solutions to sleepless nights. That is all coming up tomorrow on Central Time, along with a look at some of the top news stories of the day. That's tomorrow on Central Time.